Thank you for tuning in. This is Matt Santos of the Mile High Show. You are listening to episode number 94. It was recorded at Big Daddy E's Barbecue in Chino Valley. Check them out at BigDaddyE's.com. And don't forget, each and every Friday throughout the summer months, Big Daddy E himself, Mr. Eric Vanier, and our good friend Sky Conwell host music out on the patio from 4:30 to 6:30 each and every Friday afternoon. Sky himself plays out there, a friend of the show, Les Lyman, he's out there periodically, Paul T. Morris, and the afternoon we were out there was the great P.K. Gregory, a great singer-songwriter out of the Verde, and it was a lot of fun shoving meat in our face and listening to good music. Now, the show we recorded was done earlier in the day, and Les Lyman and Sky Conwell joined me on the microphones as we spoke with Fred Mitchum of FredMitchum.com. He is a singer-songwriter and guitar player living in Cottonwood but performing in and around the Cave Creek area, and he will be at Big Daddy's coming up, I want to say in July sometime. He's going to be out there in a few weeks. So check out FredMitchum.com, and that's Mitchum, M-I-T-C-H-I-M, FredMitchum.com. He has a very interesting history as a big fan of the psychedelic music of the 60s, primarily a fan of the 13th Floor Elevators, a group formed by Rocky Erickson back in 66, I believe. And the band and, well, primarily Rocky, were the subject of a documentary that you could watch. I believe it's on Amazon. I watched it on YouTube. It's called You're Gonna Miss Me When I'm Gone, a history of Rocky Erickson and the trials and tribulations that that he went through, suffering from a few different mental illnesses and some chemical dependencies and some other things. A fascinating documentary that chronicles the history of the 13th Floor Elevators. And that's where Fred Mitchum pops in. He was a lifelong fan of the band, of their psychedelic sound. The 13th Floor Elevators were coined as the very first psychedelic band, very influential to a lot of musicians over the years, as you will see in that documentary. If you check it out, again, it's on YouTube, You're Gonna Miss Me When I'm Gone, the story of Rocky Erickson. Now, Fred Mitchum was a big fan of the band and of their music, saw them as a teenager, we talk about that, saw them again a few times over the years, and put together a tribute band. And through that tribute band, he came in contact with the actual band members. And then in 2015, he joined them for a 13th Floor Elevator reunion. And we talked to Fred about that, about his music, about psychedelic music and psychedelic mood-altering things that he's experienced over the years, and had a lot of fun talking with Fred Mitchum at Big Daddy E's Barbecue, where he will be playing next month in July. So sit back and enjoy Fred Mitchum, myself, Sky Conwell, and Leslie Earl Lyman from the patio at Big Daddy E's Barbecue. Oh, and don't forget, this show is brought to you also by Amazon. Use the Amazon link at milehighshow.com to do all your online shopping, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. When you click on that Amazon link at milehighshow.com, it takes you to your regular Amazon login, whether it's for Amazon Standard or Amazon Prime. You do your shopping like you normally do. It just lets Amazon know that you got there through us, and they give us a little thank you in the end. So that's a way for you to get your shopping done at the same time, support the Mile High Show by using that Amazon link at milehighshow.com. Commercials over. Let's listen to Fred Mitchum talk about the psychedelic era that he is still living.
Definitely. This guy always has his appetite. He's a little guy, but man, he can pack it away.
I can tell you.
Well, thank you, Fred, for coming in and sitting down with us.
You're welcome.
We keep this pretty informal, more of a conversation than anything else. We do try and keep it. Is the determining word there, especially when you're dealing with Les Lyman here. We try and keep it as radio friendly as we can on the F bombs and I have realized that if I remove the F word and the word like from Les's vocabulary, we're pretty much in dead silence.
Well, yeah.
Dead silence, Les Lyman, that you can't use that in the same sentence. Yeah.
Well, you got your stack of CDs there. So to start out, what I'd like to do is let folks know where they can find you online, on social media, Facebook, whatever you got out there, and your iTunes info. So plug away.
Well, fredmitchum.com is the place to go, and it will direct you to whatever is interesting about me from there. And Sean French has done a pretty good job of making my website navigatable and filled with whatever it is I do.
With all the good info. And what do you got? What's your release there that you got?
I was under the impression you guys were here for having me here to talk about the elevators.
We will talk about everything you want to talk about.
Well, the elevator thing started with me forming a tribute band.
Okay.
I brought these for you guys.
Oh, well, thank you. Oh, thanks.
And
Tommy Hall schedule.
Now, the reason I wanted to go into just folks finding you right now is because you're actively playing now.
Yes.
Like before we plugged in here, you were saying you're living in Cottonwood, but playing, right here, I think. Now, you got a date here.
Got a date here. Big Daddy's. Been playing in Cave Creek at Local Johnny's.
At Cave Creek. So I found that my curiosity often runs a different direction than what people like to talk about sometimes. Okay. So for the past, since Sky set this up, I've been delving into YouTube and Wikipedia and some other spots to educate myself on the 13th floor elevators, because that was not until I started hearing the tunes and watching some of the clips going, oh no, yeah, I do know that song. It wasn't something initially that was on the top of my head. Now these two guys, their eyes lit up. They knew exactly what was going on. So that's another reason I wanted them here for sure. So I didn't want to go strictly into the past and ignore the current and the future. But we'll talk about whatever you got time to talk about. So
okay.
Let's start with what you got here. This is
so in
the Tommy Hall schedule.
In 2002, I turned 50, and no one had formed a tribute band, and it had been since 69 when they went defunct. And I wanted to hear the songs live. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I'll just do it myself. And I put this out and sent copies to the guys. They all liked it, and I started interacting with them. I was able to get John and Ronnie to come play with me.
Oh, that's awesome.
And Rocky had just returned with Sumner from Philadelphia. If you watch the documentary, Sumner came and got Rocky from his...
Rocky's younger brother, who was more of a
way
symphonic.
Sumner was first chair tuba in the symphony in Philadelphia. I think it's Philadelphia. Mm.
Yeah.
And Rocky's existence at that point had pretty much gone into a catatonic state almost. No one had heard from him during the 90s. And so Sumner came and got him, and then they came to Austin right in 2002, right as I put this together. And I got a copy to Sumner, and he gave it to Rocky. Rocky liked it. They had me come eat dinner with them at Thread Gills, where it's basically
that's awesome.
Only place
good
Rocky
eating.
Likes to
good
eat.
Good eating there, man.
And Sumner started playing and playing elevator songs in his set, and Rocky started coming to those gigs. So for the next 2 years, Rocky basically sat in the audience and watched Sumner sing his songs. And during that time, I'm playing around with the Tommy Hall schedule, a little bit with John, a little bit with Ronnie. And everybody's looking at Rocky just sitting there with his arms folded as he's thinking about doing it.
Yeah.
Then because of the Tommy Hall schedule CD, which I also got to Powell St. John, I was able to pull together a situation to record Powell St. John's first album in what was, I guess, 40 years. You know, Powell wrote for the Elevators in Austin and then went to San Francisco and became part of Mother Earth, and he's on those first two Mother Earth records. There's another version of Kingdom of Heaven on the second Mother Earth record, in case you never heard it. And it's done the original way Powell wrote it. It's pretty interesting to hear the contrast. When he originally wrote it, Stacy took the three chords that he wrote the song with and changed it into 9 or 10 chords. And so when I was able to pull this together for Powell, I showed him Stacy's version, and he opted to use that instead of his own original version when we re-recorded it. And on this CD, I was able to get the really good musicians that were playing Antones, Frosty, the infamous drummer, and a really good guitar player locally named Mac McNabb, and pull off this recording. After I recorded... Ooh.
Whoop. What'd we lose?
It's this.
No, they turned off the switch. All that did was kill our earplugs. Hey, Sky, can you go... put that switch back on, please. It, right inside the door. We'll just chop this section out. All it did was kill our headphones. It's now, still recording.
The best thing about this, and I was like, and I'd know, like, I discovered this when I learned we were going to talk to you, is you guys have the jug. That is like the most important part of the whole sound of the elevators is like the jug, you know, how the guy was, and Tommy was using it.
Well, I could veer off on that really hard, but let me finish what I was saying.
Okay, that's
cool. So the I re-recorded almost all of Powell's good stuff off those Mother Earth records and some stuff, all the stuff he did with the Elevators. And I did the songs he wrote for the Elevators twice. I did them with Frosty and Mac, and I did them with John Ike and Ronnie. Mm-hmm. So there's two discs in there. And... For the Elevators versions, where
just keep going.
Where I got Ronnie and John to play, I brought in my jug player that could fairly well imitate what Tommy
was
doing.
He does a great job, man.
Yeah, his name's Leonard Smith, and he's a local musician in Austin, and he was a trumpet player, and he could kind of sing. So I started thinking about it when I did this, and went, he could probably do this. So I bought him a jug and said, do this! And he adapted really quickly. It worked out wonderful. But as far as what you said, back in the day when they played... and I only saw him 3 times. But yeah, I can't emphasize how unbelievably powerful and psychedelic the jug came across.
Well, just the vocal part of it, you know, because he was doing more. He wasn't just keeping time. He was singing into the jug and using that sound that came out of the jug, you know, and then making it do things.
Like, well, you know, the recordings of the jug on the first record especially.
Yeah.
Some of it is absolutely amazing. I mean, you could strip away the song and just release the jug track.
Really?
It's so psychedelic.
It's really good. It's, you know.
And Tommy, although I think he was a chemistry English major at UT, might as well have been a musicologist because he was listening to all this big world stuff, you know, way before that was popular. And so his idea of what to do when the guys in the band went, come on, you need to play something with us, you know. Go grab a jug. Like, apparently, in the Texas Union building in the mid-60s, when folk took off as the Beatles had just arrived, you know, folk music was already happening, there were big hootenannies. There was even a show on TV back then called Hootenanny. And apparently Tommy would go over there with a jug with Powell. They were friends already. And Powell, big harmonica guy, and Tommy would toot, you know, their traditional kind of bass thing, which once Tommy started experimenting with acid, I'm sure became, you know, very quickly. And, you know, the guys in the band have various feelings about how popular that became and how dominant it became in the music. But for the people in the audience, I mean, once again, I just can't emphasize how freaking psychedelic it was.
Now, you said you saw them live a couple of three times?
I saw all three versions, luckily. When they first came out, they came to a teen club in the NASA area where I was living. And that was the first real band I ever saw.
What year are we talking about?
Let's see. I'm in ninth grade, 66.
Yeah.
And then...
now, they formed... What their original run was... The first run was what? 66 through 69?
Well...
Right in that window?
The first album and the first live period with Benny on bass instead of Ronnie... Didn't go for a whole year, I don't think, before they replaced him with Ronnie. And then, you know, about 60, after the 66, 67 section, then the Easter Everywhere section started kicking in. And at that point, they lost John and Ronnie and Galindo and Danny Thomas came in. And I got to see that version at the famous Love Street Light Circus Feel Good Machine, which I could talk about for an hour. Coolest club in the history of clubs.
Where was that located?
In the center of Houston.
How did they get that name on a door? You know, that's a little long.
You know, it was all international artists. Yeah. It was their club. And hilariously enough, now that you mention it, I don't ever remember seeing any sign. And there was a place called Allen's Landing in the very center of downtown Houston. It was a cul-de-sac next to where the bayou, where Main Street crossed the bayou. And there was one three-story building, and it just had one room on each floor. And the old-style fire escape stairway, wrought iron stairway, and the third floor was Love Street, and the other two floors were nothing. And the cul-de-sac was filled with hippies. You know, it was essentially a small Haight-Ashbury kind of situation
right
that happened instantly, like an atomic bomb. When it happened in San Francisco, it happened in Houston. And a lot because of the elevators.
Yeah.
You know, Tommy, with those guys getting chased out of Austin and coming to Houston where the record company was and playing all those gigs and all the influx of the mind-expanding substances, And I would have to say the NASA area brought in people from all over the world. That's where I was living, which changed the Texas dynamic that was traditionally there for the previous 100 oil years into Space City.
Yeah.
And
Was that the industry your family was in?
No, I'm an Air Force kid.
Oh, gotcha.
My dad got transferred to a little Air Force base next door to NASA, which was servicing NASA.
Gotcha.
And my older brother, 5 years older than me, so when we get there, it's 64, and within a few months, it's... My brother's a senior at 65, and him and his friends call me into their bedroom one night and go, listen to this, and it was You're Gonna Miss Me. And they had already been going out and seeing it.
Yeah.
And that's how it began for me.
That's what I wanted to touch on. As you were talking, I'm thinking, you know, freshman year of high school, you're what, 14, 15, something like that.
Well,
and you hear these guys for the first time?
In ninth grade, we go to the Tiki Teen Club outside of Kima, and the elevators play the first record.
Obviously, they had an impact on you because some, how many years later in 02, you said, you did
well,
your tribute?
Well, as far as the impact goes, being the first real band I ever saw, yeah, it had a huge impact.
Why? What was it that grabbed you?
Well, you know, since I was in ninth grade and I was listening to the Mod English Invasion, and luckily we had just moved here to Texas from California, where the radio was a bit more a bit better, and I had a better education going and the roots of actual rock. And so, you know, the thing about the elevators is it was concocted off of the foundation of the roots of blues and rock, the way Stacy and Rocky learned and what they learned from. And, I mean, it really helped a lot that they grew up in Texas.
Yeah.
And I think it helped a lot that John and Ronnie and Stacy grew up in Kerrville. Like, you know, John... Where's came Kerrville? Out and played the first jazz rock drums ever. If you listen to that first record, he's playing jazz rock drums. And that had to have evolved sort of from the fact that he was around all that swing drumming. Because John is not an acid guy. That didn't evolve because he was all high. It just evolved naturally. And he's like a banjo guy. And you know, he has a lot of musical influences going. But
so this was a good stew, so to speak, of different influences. And just taking pieces, whatever grabbed them from different formats of music and blending it into unique sound.
The psychedelic thing, that you know, they're attributed as being the original psychedelic band.
Right.
And if taking acid and playing made that happen, then it made it happen real fast. Because when they came out and played, like you hear on that first record, Ronnie is playing this hypnotic thud on his bass that is essentially now the kick drum. And John's drum mix back in those days, he's playing decorative, orchestrative jazz rock drums around the bottom end of the song, which is being held down by Ronnie. And that kind of feel with this insane jug, you know, going on. And then Stacy's playing all this straight-ahead R&B rock guitar.
Yeah.
Just gave and then let's settle on the real thing that happened. Rocky's unbelievable
vocals.
Voice.
Yeah.
Like the words right at the beginning, you couldn't really tell what they were saying, and they hadn't released the album yet. But if you walked into a teen dance hall, you know, those reverby concrete aluminum dance halls, and they were all over Houston, Pasadena, and the surrounding area, Galveston. They were playing every weekend. My brother and his friends were going, and that's how I got drug into it. But, like, the sound that you hear on that first record, that can be bothersome at first if you're from the world of produced and perfect rock because of all the reverb and everything. But that was the sound, and it was completely hypnotic, even if you were just a little kid and you weren't high, which was me.
Yeah. You were going in clean palate then. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. I'm in ninth grade. You know?
Can I guess your brother wasn't?
Yes, you can guess my brother wasn't. You know, everything had happened, and he was a surf guy, and the surf guys were what turned into the hippie scene.
Yeah,
yeah. They already knew where to get good smoke, and it was already all happening.
Now, when did you start developing your musical? Your performance end of the music.
Okay, so over the next couple of years, I'm listening to Easter Everywhere, and I start to do my own mental exploration with the guidance of Mr. Hall's lyrics. And it was pretty obvious if you started reading his lyrics once they came out, which books he was reading. So those of us that were interested would get those books and do our own deductions from them. And in a way, Easter Everywhere was almost an instruction manual for me to open my mind, so to speak. And then 12th grade rolls around, and I'm listening to Bull of the Woods, and I luckily enough got to see that formation with just Stacy and probably Duke Davis on bass, I'm not sure. Danny Thomas on drums, and a little vocal help from the singer, from a guy in a band called Lost and Found. And so anyway, at that point, I ended up in my first band in my senior year, and I had to teach myself to sing because I hadn't. I was going to be a visual artist, not a musician. Mm-hmm. So I, from a non-musical family, I had to teach myself real quickly. I'd been writing lyrics on my own since sixth grade. I got activated by the Monster Mash of all songs. But by the time lyrics became super interesting, I started writing my own. And the guys I was hanging out with who played guitars decided that we should make a band and I should write the lyrics. And since I wrote the lyrics, I should sing. So I used Rocky's voice as something to try and model myself after. And that's how I started learning the songs.
Yeah.
We didn't end up playing hardly any of the songs in my first band in 69, but we did start out with Baby Blues, their version on Easter Everywhere, and I still do that version. From there out, I wrote my own songs. We were an all-original psychedelic band. We all wrote, and it stayed like that in my various music endeavors until 2002. And then at 50, with not much success, I decided, I'm just going to take a break from my own material and the various things that I do, and I'm going to learn their songs and play them. It's going to be a good way to relax and have fun. Instead, it took off, so to speak.
Yeah.
And as far as having fun, not making money.
Now, how much were them, 13th Floor Elevators, how much were they on the radar in that period of time from the late 70s up through, like you said, Rocky had disappeared through the 90s?
Well, you
but
know,
up till the time you were doing your tribute stuff, had
no visibility,
none at all.
Like, there were three reunions, I think, one each decade, and they were tragically unprepared and didn't take hold. And Rocky's condition from way back then, all during his solo career, he had to struggle with his mental condition and things that were happening. And so he was never that interested. He put out all those Rocky solo albums and created an entire career for himself.
Yeah.
Ronnie and John stayed in Kerrville and started playing with various local bands, had nothing to do with the Elevators. And
where's Kerrville in relation to?
Kerrville is an hour west of San Antonio.
Okay.
And, Stacy got killed in the 70s and wasn't part of the first reunion anyway. So there was not, Tommy went to San Francisco and basically became a recluse. Hmm. And if you said, even tried to, and I was lucky enough, I ended up in San Francisco in 72 and ended up meeting him for the first time and was around him on and off a little bit for the next 3 months. And if you tried to talk to him about the Elevators, he just wouldn't do it.
Really?
And then all these decades later, the story was the same. When I did the Tommy Hall schedule, I went on the internet and there was the Elevators group. It was run by this guy named The Llama. He was a Swedish guy. And George Ripley was part of the Elevators group. He's this guy that lives in San Francisco and is a huge collector. And he emailed me and said, I know Tommy. Send me a CD. I'll give it to him. And I did. And Tommy liked it. And they invited me to eat dinner with them. And I was going to California. So in roughly still 2002, again, I get to meet Tommy. And we all went out to dinner and went and saw Johnny Winter's concert. That evening was more fascinating talking to him than the other 10 times I talked to him in 72 when he had just returned from living in the woods behind San Diego where nobody heard from him. Nobody knew what was going on. He just reappeared in San Francisco while I was there. And I'm hanging out with my older brother's friends, and they were all part of the peripheralist crowd. So he showed up.
Yeah.
There's a couple hours of stories there. Then all these years later, Tommy just softened up, and I would guess it was, of course, because of facing his mortality. He had a major heart attack and just said, well, you know, like he was in the hospital, and he was talking to George Ripley, and he said, I'm in the mood.
Mm. So just perfect timing.
Within a year, we were on stage at Levitation.
You coming up with your project right at the time when he was apparently ready to embrace the past.
No. I did the Tommy Hall schedule in 2002, and then we was reintroduced. Like I said, we had dinner. It was 12 years later that all of a sudden he has a heart attack and gets in the mood, and then it all came together.
So you did 2015 when they reunited.
I was on stage at Levitation.
How cool is that?
Well, for me, that kind of shot my bucket list.
Cool.
I mean, because like Tommy had always said, this will never happen. And Rocky never acted interested. And Stacy was dead. And it just seemed like I never even entertained the idea. Yeah. And really, if Tommy hadn't got in the mood, I don't think it could have happened. Because you can get Rocky and you can get John and you can get Ronnie and then fill in Stacy with me and Eli. Eli Southard was playing most of Stacy's parts. I was basically playing Rocky's parts. Hmm. It still wouldn't really be the Elevators without Tommy. And everybody in the immediate crowd felt that way too. So when Tommy said, let's do it, then the Rob Kirkpatrick and those guys who do the Levitation Fest just jumped all over it.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of a tribute to those guys. I mean, the biggest thing that I remember about the Elevators is that, you know, the band wasn't on stage, but their music, if you were of a certain bent, was eventually presented to you. It was like, you got it, like, you like this, like, you like that, you have to listen to this guy, these guys, and this guy in particular, because this is where it came from. And you'd go, get out of here. And then you'd listen to the album and go, my God, because you would hear, like, kind of where Janis got a lot of the screams and howls that she did, and you would hear, like, you know, like you know, where Robert Plant lifted, you know, some of the stuff he did, and you would hear like the mix you're talking about, R&B guitar and jazz drums and stuff like that. You would hear where that came from, and it was, you know, and just look at the date on the recording, and you knew where it came from. You're like, my God, and then you would listen to this. And listen to the words, and listen to the mix, and listen to the reverb, you know, the reverb in particular, because nowadays, as you said, we don't do that, you know, like, but it was drowning in reverb, and all of a sudden you're hearing where that sound that we associated with San Francisco came from, you know, and stuff, where I was like, and I remember going, my God, this is where it started. So they were always there, and people, like, almost all the bands that play at, it was Psych Fest, I think, first, right, that played there would, like list the Elevators way the heck up here on their list of influences, you know. And so I always thought that thing was almost a tribute to those guys, was a tribute to the Elevators, to try to get them, you know, to keep them, in, you know, like, this is where it started, represent, you know. Texas music is like that. Texas is a rich, rich place for, like, people doing their own thing, and then the rest of the world figuring it out later on.
It's interesting. You mentioned Janis Joplin. She was born and raised in Texas, and then she moved into San Francisco. So yeah. I wonder if that's the Elevators really is a huge influence on Janis Joplin.
Well, okay. So I talked to Powell about Janis, and Powell is as old or maybe a year or two older than Tommy. So we're talking that these guys are now in their 70s.
Right.
And Powell is a huge blues folk enthusiasts. Powell dug up Mance Lipscomb. Mance Lipscomb was retired, living outside of Austin, and Powell went and got him to play at Threadgill's during this early period. And then this girl shows up in town. She hitchhikes into town with her auto harp. Her name is Janis. She becomes his girlfriend.
Oh.
I love this. He takes her over to the Hootenanny at the Texas Union Building, probably with Tommy sitting behind her going, dook, dook, dook. And And of course, you can imagine when she started singing what the rest of the Hootenanny people felt like, their own voices. And so immediately the elevators happens, and immediately she gets enlisted by Chet Helms. If you don't know much about Chet Helms, Chet Helms is this Austin guy. I'm not really crystal clear on his background either, but he's even a few years older. He saw the San Francisco thing coming. He moved out there. He got a big house with a big basement, and he started nurturing Big Brother, Quicksilver, Country Joe and the Fish, and the Airplane. I mean, this is insane that this guy did this. He had as much effect on the consciousness of the youth of the nation as Timothy Leary did.
Interesting.
Right?
Wow.
Yeah, according to what I've read, he helped them with their arrangements, with giving them a place to rehearse, getting gigs, their lyrics, everything.
Well, he basically made it happen.
That's how I'm looking at it. He hitchhikes back to Austin once he hears about Janice, convinces her to hitchhike back to San Francisco with him because he has this band called Big Brother.
Yeah. Wasn't there talk of her joining the elevators?
No. As far as I know, she simply knew Rocky, maybe heard them a couple times, and so she got out there, and if you listen to the first Big Brother album, her voice has not gone up to that place yet. The first Big Brother album, she sings very controlled, strong folk vocals.
Yeah.
The next album is the legendary Cheap Thrills, Janis Joplin, that will go on into the future forever. Whether or not Rocky actually was a part of why she started screaming like that, I wish we could ask her.
I would bet a shiny nickel because you hear things and idea like musical ideas that other people do and they stick in your head, you know, and it's not always lyrics. It's not like, but it's like, you know, that's a really interesting thing to do. I like that emotion and stuff. And that's really where she became important was where she like got out on stage and went, here is my pain. You know, and she had a lot to be. She had a lot to be in pain about, but it's the way she did it. I mean, you can almost. It's almost like you know, the guitar player still riffs, right? You can hear the riff she stole. Mm-hmm. You can hear, and it's not like any other female singer that I'd heard, up to that point. You would hear. Like Billie Holiday emotion, that sort of controlled sort of Miles Davis, like underneath the veneer of Al. But Janis just sort of, Rocky just went and Janis went, just ripped it out and threw it on stage for you to like wade in, man.
But, in my opinion, at this point, the two historic vocalists are him and her. That came from the psychedelic period.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you still hear Rocky's voice through Janis, through female singers in every state you go to, you hear people doing that. You know, it's still. I mean, it's like, it's one of those things that stuck. It's one of those things that stuck. It changed the way everybody sang rock and blues and stuff like that. And that's why Rocky's important. I think is because of that, not because of commercial success, not because of. Virtuoso guitar playing. What he did was he said, it's okay for us to do this. It's okay to get on here and bleed, and it's okay for us to get on here and bleed, And I think that's cool. I think it's very cool. It's like, it's just not, it's not something that was done prior to that. Like you said, it was this controlled folk scene,
Everything else a little, like you said, produced clean. Yeah.
Well,
this really stood out.
And in the book and in the documentary, it's they talk about the fact that Rocky was already a rock star in high school, and he would model his voice after James Brown and Little Richard and these guys. So screaming, he lifted from them. And then inserted it into white boy rock.
Well, there you go. Well, we all stand on the shoulders of giants, but it was a little different. was a little different. But, you know,
one was fueled by the psychedelic emergence and one wasn't. I mean, actually, I don't think there could ever be vocal performances with the ferocity that Rocky, because it wasn't mm-hmm. just him and it wasn't just the psychedelic era. It was a factors build up, like they would say in defensive driving. Mm. That led to this incredible situation where everything was raw. You know, rock was raw, the audience was raw, the situation was raw, social politics was raw.
Like a history thing.
And, you know, but back in the 60s when this whole psychedelic mind expansion thing came up, there was none of that talk, except in the beatnik community. Yeah. And the beatnik community was a secret community of coffee-drinking guys dressed in black, you know. But they were at the University of Texas, and that's where Tommy and Powell were. And for instance, in Austin in the early 60s, there was a cactus farm on the edge of Austin called Hudson's. Everything is completely legal, you know, even LSD. And you could drive out to Hudson's, and they had bins of peyote buttons and sunflower, morning glory seeds, excuse me. And so probably Rocky and his high school were having a great time along with the University of Texas.
Oh, yeah.
So as Rocky learned to sing and scream in this special prehistoric moment, all these different factors created a situation which just can't be duplicated.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think a vocalist, I've been waiting all these decades, which is one of the reasons I did the Tommy Hall schedule. You know, when is this going to happen again? It's like, when is Jimi Hendrix going to happen again? It's just not going to happen again. If you like what you hear in your musician, just try to, and you want to hear it live, you better interpret it yourself because it's not going to happen again.
Yeah, yeah. That's some wisdom there. I completely agree. You know, because a lot of that, like you said, was historical. And, you know, we live in a time now that is fairly historically significant, I think.
There's, hell yes.
You know, fairly. There's a lot. But and so what I'm waiting, I think that if something was going to happen like that, right? You know, I'm sort of waiting for something like that to come out, like this primal scream of music, you know, because that from like the you know, once again from the kids, you know, because the kids
my guess is it will come out of Russia or China, not America.
You know, that's a brilliant idea. That's brilliant.
Because the oppression and the decades of pain that we have not been experiencing here in comparison, if the right young group of kids gets the right electric instruments and starts writing, it could happen again. But I think it would be there.
That's a great prediction.
I like that idea. Imagine
some kind of elevatory group emerging out of China.
I could.
You know, and it does. It takes that. There's that mixture of. You know, that mixture of you got to have the oppression.
You got to have the oppression.
You got to have the oppression because, like you don't. That's really where, like, the, you know, that societal, like, soul deep pain of like being held down by the man, right? You know, for want of a better word.
The Vietnam War actually contributed for every action. There's an equal and opposite reaction, and trying to draft all of the teens into becoming soldiers caused the other teens to not want to be anything even vaguely like a soldier.
Well, yeah.
Or it, when they returned. Like, you know, Ronnie Leatherman actually got drafted and had to go to Vietnam.
Yeah.
To me, that is a story that is unbelievably fascinating. Imagine being in the original psychedelic group that ever happened, and playing the gigs he played, hearing the music he heard, talking to the talk he was around, and then you get a letter in the mail. And then you're holding a machine gun in Vietnam.
Oh, man.
Then you're back. And the elevators are still alive enough for him to get back involved. I mean, can you think of another? I mean, Rocky's story is unbelievable. Yeah. So is Ronnie's.
Well, I think that like if you talk to anybody, yeah, it's really interesting. If you, like when like you and I are of an age, I think. Yeah, I think you're probably about. You're probably, you maybe got a decade on me, I think, maybe.
I'm 64.
Yeah, you got about almost exactly a decade on me. But
you can get a job at the fair.
You know, there you go, man.
If we had one.
If we had a fair. Shh, stop fomenting dissent. Anyway, but just things, you know, like the things were changing, becoming, you know, doing, and like you and I, like I in particular, I'm on the back end of that whole boomer generation, right? So like I'm just sort of part of it, but really I wasn't old enough to take part in the cool stuff, if you will. So I grew up like in the late, you know, I came of age in the late 70s, and by that time, you know, think like that we were in this process of trying not to think about the war and trying not to think about, you know, the things that sort of drove that kind of thing. There was, you know, like things that they were trying to normalize stuff, and then we walked into the 80s.
Well, you know, the other thing about the psychedelic moment in general, which all comes back to Tommy, is the lyrics. Like, okay, so the Bob Dylan and the Beatles took lyrics to an emotional place with meaning instead of just boy-girl lyrics. And then Tommy took it somewhere else, all by himself. And at the time, to this day, if you want to go listen to other bands play really psychedelic music with really psychedelic lyrics, there's a limited selection from the Beatles and the Grateful Dead, and a little bit from Country Joe, and a little bit from the Jefferson Airplane, and not hardly anything else. It turns out, of course, the hardest thing to do would be to write lyrics on that level, which... Now that it's been 50 years or so, and no one has written anything even vaguely close to just the lyrics in Slip Inside This House, I would once again say, it ain't going to happen.
Sure.
You know, it's just like Bob Dylan in his interviews goes, I can't write lyrics like I did. You know, those series of songs like a Rolling Stone and everything, that happened. And that's, I can't do it again. And probably not, won't be able to.
And he's not that guy anymore either.
What happens.
Yeah, it's a combination of life experience.
So those lyrics,
political.
Just, you know, when we were all young and suddenly started reading those lyrics, that took as much precedent as anything else that was a topic when we were young. It ended up being an ongoing conversation that lasted for years, just discussing a single line or a verse in Dust, Leave Your Body Behind, or Slip Inside This House, mainly. You know, funny enough, over the years, Kingdom of Heaven is the most popular elevator song, which was written by Powell. And Powell is a folk guy, and also, I mean, I've been hassling him, literally, you know, because we're friends, and I can poke at him a little bit, you know, come on, man, I know you're a folk guy, write another, just one more, and he's like, well, you know, and when I first met him, this is revealing, when I did the Tommy Hall schedule, and he got it, and I had this chance to eat dinner with Tommy, I contacted Powell and said, so, can I drop by and talk to you also? Do you have any more material? Maybe I could put something on a Tommy Hall schedule nobody had ever heard before. So anyway, I pull up to his house from the airport. He comes to the door. He brings me inside. He asks me if I want a cup of tea. We walk into the kitchen. It's been about 6 or 7 minutes, and I couldn't help myself. I blurted out, so how did a folk guy write Kingdom of Heaven? And he looked at me and went, well, I took mescaline and floated up out of my body. and so there's these, you know, I mean, I hate to put it like that's an important factor because I don't believe that drugs are an essential tool in mind expansion. I think the whole New Age movement centered around meditation and healing and herbs and self-hypnotism is a path to the same place. Unfortunately for American civilization in the mid-60s, there was no access to any kind of talk like this whatsoever. When Maharishi came on The Tonight Show because the Beatles had discovered him, and he talked about higher states of consciousness, you know, we're like, we're sitting in our living rooms with our parents, you know, going, what?
What does that
but
mean?
Tommy had already started, you know, like the paragraph on the, well, it's several paragraphs on the back of the first record, Psychedelic Sounds of the 13th Floor Elevators, came out, and there was, like I said, we weren't really sure what the lyrics were yet because all you could hear was in those reverb-y teen halls. Knew something was going on. And if you were in the peripheral of their crowd, there was a lot of interpretation and talk. And Tommy himself would lecture at the gigs and after the gigs. And anytime, if you were lucky enough to just be in a room with him, you didn't get a chance to talk. He was stream of consciousness. And when I ran back into him in this early 70s, same thing. I barely ever got to ask a question or say anything. But to tell you the truth, who cares? Who has as much interesting stuff to say as Tommy Hall? No one. I'm sorry to say. I've never seen any interview by any famous anybody, author, music, anybody who could had any as nearly as much interesting stuff to say. Even though, you basically better like poets and poetry. Although I don't think he will refer to himself as that, but he is a stream of consciousness poet, and you can sit there for an hour, and he will extrapolate on the verses of the songs or what he's thinking, and it's you can see how he wrote the lyrics while he's talking, because it becomes lyrical.
That's cool. Yeah, that's cool. But I got sidetracked. It's not this conversation is just like so endlessly interesting to me because it touches a lot of things that I like. But the guys that when we were growing up, you would talk to the guys that it might be the guy who drove the bus. It might be the guy that that old dude across the street that was he's 55, then. And it turns out this guy was in the Marines, and probably would turn out you'd talk to the guy, and if you could get him in a room where he could speak his mind, you would find out he's probably one of the most pacifistic guy you ever met in your whole life, totally against war. Most of the guys that come back, most of the Vietnam vets you meet, they come back. They have really cool stories to tell about just the times. But most of them come back, and they're very much there's no, they don't remember it fondly, if you will. And they remember it fondly. And they're very, it's just fascinating listening to these guys talk about the time, what they expected. A lot of these guys ended up in boot camp somewhere because they got a piece of paper in the mail, and they weren't lucky enough to get into the guard, and off they went, and they would come back to their life, and they might be a musician, they might be, they would just go back to the world, and you would never associate these guys with some of the stories they would tell if you could get a beer in them to get them to talk to you, So the fact that I would love to hear that guy just the process of him leaving Texas, going through boot camp,
don't ever expect to hear anything from Ronnie.
No, that would be interesting.
Yeah, it can't be anything but as fascinating. Yeah. But Ronnie is not one of those guys that's ever going to talk about it.
Yeah.
So it ain't going to happen.
Which is like a shame, and it's a good thing for him, and it's a shame at the same time. But they're all kind of like that. They have to be comfortable with you, and it's sort of like they're telling you their deepest, darkest secrets, And
there's two kinds of vets. Like my dad was a World War II guy, and my dad did unbelievable stuff in World War II, but he didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
But he also wasn't disturbed about it.
Yeah.
Now, on the other side, the guys who will talk about it or won't talk about it because it disturbed them, you may or may not want to hear what they have to say. I have a friend who's a hardcore Vietnam vet, and I've known him for 20 years. Right before I moved away from Austin, I was casually sitting and talking to him, and he just, for the first time ever, blurted out one of his Vietnam stories.
Yeah.
And it was like a scene in Apocalypse Now. Yeah. I wasn't sure I wanted to know once he was done. And it only took 60 seconds for me to tell him this one little story. So, once again, back then, the confluence of events that occurred. On one side, these guys are going and returning with all this incredible, life-changing events beyond human belief, really, because at that young, be thrown into something like that. Once again, it wasn't considered a war. It was a police action. So the whole thing was, there was questionable morality to it. And at the same time, they're drafting these guys that are high as a kite, and they get over there and they can get even higher because the Vietnam weed is even better. And so they're in action high, and then they return and get high again. the late 60s, you know, it took a huge toll on a lot of guys and sent a lot of guys like Tommy into a hermit-like existence. Hopefully once again, you know, that will never happen. Yeah. Like these days with a volunteer army and everything, it's a different situation. Back then, the draft and all that, and like I said, it wasn't even actually called a war. It was, you know, as a high school kid, I remember watching TV one night to see if I won or lost the lottery to get drafted to go to Vietnam. And I lost. I was in my senior year in my first psychedelic band going, I just lost the lottery.
Damn.
You know, I wiggled my way out. But.
You know, I mean, it was different TV, too. It was different TV, too, because I was old enough to, like, remember watching that stuff, you know. And then it was different TV, too. It wasn't as... I don't even know what word to use, but it was more raw. It was kind of like how we're doing this. It was more like, here's our footage, you know. And there wasn't that thing that you have
well,
now.
Well, the media is processed now. Yeah. Back then, it was Walter Cronkite and his friends.
Yeah.
It was a different situation.
So
I'm a little bit younger than you guys. And my father was in the Air Force. He spent a couple of years in Vietnam. And ask me how many stories I know.
Yeah.
None.
Exactly.
Yeah, a couple of years. And he just doesn't talk about it. He never has. And
I only got my stories from my mother. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's
secondhand stories.
That kind of guy, you know.
Well, it was a different mindset on manhood and what you talked about and what you didn't talk about.
Yeah.
You know, too. So. You know, different world, different place. You know, different place.
World. It's literally
like different. No, seriously, different society. Even it's like we're talking about this, and it's almost like, for me, it's almost like archaeology, because there's a point where you have to start extrapolating things instead of going, I know this, I know that, because you know that's not my life at this point. You know, that's not my life at this point. Even though I was kind of there for some of it.
Let's circle back a little bit to when, what festival was it that you played with them?
Levitation.
The Levitation.
Last year.
What was that like, getting on stage with those guys?
Well.
And leading up to it. What kind of prep work did you have?
Leading up to it, you know, like I said, Austin became no fun for me, and I was just, it was 2015, it was May, and
Screaming.
I basically had no more gigs. You know, I'm not playing out, I'm just working and writing at my house, and the phone rings, and those guys go, we're going to play a gig, you want to play guitar? And I go, of course. And so they give me... I think it was 24 hours to show up at the rehearsal, which is no big deal because, you know, I just spent 12 years playing the songs. And we went over to this little recording studio in South Austin, and John and Ronnie were set up, and this guy Eli Southard was there. He plays with Rocky and has for several years now. And he had meticulously learned all of Stacy's parts. Like, in the Tommy Hall schedule, I didn't try to imitate Stacy. I would learn his parts, but I would play a Strat, and I would use an echo machine and stuff, but I was using different tone settings, and I didn't try to play lead guitar like him. I wanted to use the Tommy Hall schedule as a psychedelic jam band. You know, I would play the songs like they are. I didn't think the idea of changing them at all was a good idea. But when you get to the lead break, I wanted to stretch it out and play more of a Grateful Dead-y kind of thing and then come back and finish the song. This guy, Eli, sat down, got the tones, got the reverbs, got the leads, everything. It's wonderful. It's just wonderful. So this first rehearsal that I show up at, Rocky walks in, and at this point he has not played with John or Ronnie in 50 years or whatever it's been, 45 years. Comfortable because Eli's there, and he knows me. I had already got him to sing on this and taken him out to dinner a bunch of times, and so everything was like he was just comfortable. And within 60 seconds of the first song, I saw him smile. in a way. Nice. I have never seen him smile, wow, except in the pictures from the old days.
Yeah.
And so I knew right then that his body memory had been reawakened by the way John and Ronnie play, much less Eli coming in with those exact parts.
Yeah.
And so that first little audition rehearsal was a really memorable experience, because basically just the look on Rocky's face, that because Rocky smiling is unusual, you know.
Yeah.
And so then we set up the actual rehearsals a few days before the gigs, and Tommy shows up. And I hadn't seen Tommy in all those years, but Tommy is a really likable, happy guy. And you wouldn't expect that from somebody who's so serious, but he is. So the atmosphere in the rehearsal room was really good, and Rocky came in, and let me back up here. Rocky hadn't shown up yet, and so part of the thing about having me there is we could rehearse all the songs exactly like they're going to be, because I can sing them. And so we, for me, as an lifelong experience that I'll always remember, I'm with the elevators minus Rocky. Tommy's right here, mm-hmm, on the jug, and I get to go through the elevator set fronting the band. And with Eli cracking the parts like that, and the way Ronnie and John sound together, Ronnie and John have a body memory that's off the charts. I've always done almost everything with them with no rehearsal. I've gone up on the stage with them live in various little clubs around Austin in the preceding years with the Tommy Hall schedule with zero rehearsal, and knock the songs out like we rehearse them. Huh. Totally aghast. Those guys are just unbelievable. So that first half of the rehearsal where I got to do it with them, it sounded, you know, it was the Tommy Hall schedule premium plus. And then Rocky came in, and we were warmed up. And he, like I said, he's in a good mood. And we had this incredible rehearsal that was just, you know, once again, this as exciting as playing in front of 10,000 people at the Levitation Fest. Just being in a room with the freaking elevators and having the song sound like that and go, you know, and be able to be there, much less playing them. You know, so there's only 2 days of this. So the next day, it all goes really well again.
Grab that if you'll pop it out. Okay. There. That's more comfortable for you. It'll make you a hunchback there.
The next day goes really well again, and we knew that if everything goes accordingly, we could walk out on stage and it would be pretty much like it's going to be. And the reason I'm saying pretty much is because if you're a Rocky fan, if you watch Rocky over the years, Rocky, because of his condition, he'll change up the songs sometimes. He'll sing them. He'll put things in different order. So you got to really be on top of it. Now, all of us knew the songs well enough that we can change with him and do that. And so the excitement factor and the non-secure factor is, in my opinion, the original rock and roll feeling that you have when you're young. Like, oh, my God, is this going to happen?
Not sure you what's going to happen once you get out there. Huh?
But that energy is where it's at. Mm-hmm. So and John Ike is a hilarious guy. He leaves 5 hours before we're supposed to play and does not return until 15 minutes. We're walking up to the stage, setting our equipment up, and John Ike said, hey, is it time? And so that added a little excitement. And
that is rock and roll.
Yeah,
rock
exactly, man. And so I'm like, okay, let's do this. This is going to be exciting.
Swinging without the net.
And exactly. And for Rocky, you know, Rocky's voice is lowered, as all of ours have, as we've gotten older over the years. Rocky, and he did this a little at the rehearsals. He started lifting his voice back up into that octave where he actually sang the songs originally. And that, just that little energy was like setting things on fire. You know, much less having Tommy there, but to have Rocky kind of lift his voice up from the way everybody's used to hearing him sing just made it crazy exciting.
A little bit of time travel going on.
Yeah, and so, like, you know, I'm not a huge internet guy. I don't really keep up with how the Elevator fan base may or may not have grown over the years. But so I look out into the audience, and as far as I can see, people are mouthing the words. All these people who weren't born yet are mouthing the words.
Nice. That was my next question. Yeah. How did the audience react? And what was that feeling
like? So not only were they completely, you know, we were the second to the last band in front of Flaming Lips 3 days later. In essence, the posters that were put out were the Elevators were headlining.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking, well, this will be interesting. And like I said, sure enough, the younger generation, they've completely absorbed the Elevators in a way I never expected. Their fan base has grown exponentially. It's incredible. And
now, obviously, the internet plays into that with people being able to go back and pull YouTube clips and stuff. But also with the bands that were influenced by the Elevators now influence it kind of – domino effect.
I would say the internet has everything to do with it. Yeah.
Who do you see now playing that that you could see the Elevators in influencing them?
No one.
Nobody.
To tell you the truth. To tell you the truth, I understand and believe how all these young guys what they're saying. But when I listen to their songs, I do not hear it.
No.
I want to hear it. I want to hear. Like I said, if it comes out of China, I don't care. Please, God, send us another young. They don't even have to be young. Just another completely wild psychedelic band, please. Now, I like the current resurgence of psychedelic music played by all the young bands. But it sounds way more San Francisco.
Gotcha.
And it sounds way less like they tend to want to go to the Country Joe and the Fish, Velvet Underground, the slow side of Pink Floyd. They like the slow, powerful throb and the unconfused, high-powered instrumental sections. Like when they go into their leads and stuff, none of the lead guitar players, if there's any lead guitar, want to go. I kind of understand if you listen to Hendrix and all this stuff, why would you want to try to get past that? You're probably not going to be able to. But in my opinion, I'm almost sad now that the guitar players were so good when we were young, because I want to hear each young guitar player's personal idea of how to do it, not whether he's as good or better.
Yeah.
It's just like in painting. You don't have to be as good as the masters, but you better be as imaginative.
Yeah. Imaginative
is the whole deal.
It's like now that you're right. Like I see, there's a lot of kids I see. They're really good at execution. They're not really good at the imagination and, you know, like trying to find something different to play, you know. And I get I'm competent at what I do. I get all these compliments a lot of times from younger kids, and I'm like they're playing circles around me, but not one of them is going, how can I be my own person? How can I say this differently? How can I do this way? They're sounding just like Dave Gilmour or Jimmy or whoever, you know, or Stevie or whoever, you know.
Well, I haven't heard you play, but I'm guessing I think this is a huge factor. All the young guitar players that I've heard, and I'm talking for 30 years now, none of them are drawn to learn what Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix and Stacy Sutherland grew up learning to play.
Yeah.
And so I myself am guilty of this. Since I'm a little bit younger, like I said, my older brother drew me into this. I was barely old enough to get into it, and it was very lucky. But I went for quite a while, decades of thinking, you know, I don't have to worry about all this roots stuff that my heroes learned. And I was wrong. Yeah. And so I went back and sort of retaught myself how to play guitar based on the traditional R&B roots, rocks, chords and leads. And sure enough, for me, it ended up being a transformative event, and I would suggest that to all the young guitar players, no matter what you think about the stuff, that Eric Clapton and Hendrix and those guys grew up listening to. And if you look into Hendrix, Hendrix not only liked the solid blues guys, he ended up on the road being the only guitar player in and those tours that had 12 bands. You know, so he played for Little Richard, he played for the Isley Brothers. All that incredibly psychedelic guitar playing is based on R&B and funk and rock.
Sure. And then just making it his own.
And oh my God, yeah, turning it up.
All right, so somebody like myself who's just barely sticking his toe into what is the 13th floor elevators. Give me three tunes that people need to experience these guys.
Slip Inside This House is their most famous. Dust is their most profound, and Postures, also called Leave Your Body Behind, might be the most esoteric.
That's what's going to grab.
And you know, since everybody's a little different, you can listen to them in any order. Get the lyrics off of the internet or from Paul Drummond's book. And if you aren't reading Paul Drummond's lyrics, you are probably reading somebody's weird version. I've gone on the internet. Like, you can type in lyrics to, you know. When I recently re-recorded Slip Inside This House with Powell and Tommy for the Tommy documentary. George Ripley's been trying to put together this Tommy Hall documentary, and he wanted to use Tommy's best lyrics without getting involved with Charlie Records, which he would have to do if he used the original Elevators recordings. So I offered Tommy and Powell, said, yeah, we'll do these simpler acoustic versions featuring the lyrics.
Yeah.
And when at that period, I wanted to check on like one or two words. And so I Googled Slip Inside This House lyrics, and I got the most outrageous. I mean, I had to think it was a guy in Russia who just learned English.
Interesting.
And I mean, every line
was
wrong.
Well, maybe he's getting ready to be that breakout guy you were waiting for.
That would be funny.
Excuse me while I kiss this guy.
So anyway, you know, this guy, Paul Drummond, this English guy who put this book out a few years ago, I Mind, is not only the best rock biography I've ever read. He actually researched and told the story, I think, as good as it can be told.
Nice.
Because it's a very complicated, very weird story, and it makes a lot of people very emotional about the various aspects of it. So he went, drove down the middle of the road, got the facts, and the best of all, got the lyrics and printed them.
And who's the author in the book?
The book is called I Mind, The Psychedelic Sounds of the 13th Floor. Well, that's not the alternate title. It says Rocky Erickson after I Mind, and then it says The Sounds of the 13th Floor.
And that's by who?
Paul Drummond.
And I bet you, I'll bet less is shiny nickel that you can get that on Amazon.
Absolutely.
By using the Amazon link at milehighshow.com. How's that?
And if you're an elevator fan and you go into it, there's been a box set. Paul Drummond organized a box set, and once again, there's a booklet in it. It's got a bunch of the lyrics. The every decent or possibly every recording available is in this box set, including versions of like the first record and all this reverb we were talking about. Mm. There's version of the recording without all the reverb.
Interesting.
Which is very interesting.
Nice.
It has a very nice feel to it.
So who's breakout now? Who do you see on the horizon that maybe people don't know yet, and that you're looking for, that you think will be?
Well, people sort of know about this guy, and when Sean Lennon first started recording about 10 years ago, he recorded a song called Raw Meat that was on his first record, and I think it has to do with what he feels about his father's death. And it was the only song I liked on that first.
Isn't he working with Les Claypool?
Well, that's what I was going to get
yeah,
to.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So they wanted to. Sean has now evolved to a point where last year, his band Ghost of a Sabretooth Tiger, to me, sounded like Magical Mystery Tour. There was some really, really cool parts, and I was like marveling at the fact that finally, somebody who can is willing to go back into this area and pull this psychedelic feeling into their music. And so now I haven't heard any of it, but just a few days ago, this friend of mine goes, oh, yeah, Sean Lennon and Claypool from Primus have released an album called...
It's the Claypool Lennon Delirium. Because that's the name of the project. I don't know what the album's called, but it's really, I like Primus. I thought Primus was somebody that came out and went, look, we can be different. We can do this. And they were probably as close to anything that was psychedelic that I'd heard in a long, long,
insane.
Long time. They were like, you know, like the whole, the Tommy the Cat thing is actually one of my favorite things to hum to myself when I'm working, you know. But I listened to a couple of tracks. As soon as I can find a couple extra ducats, I'm going to go ahead and download that thing just because it's cool. You know, it's a good listen.
Hey Fred, do you, I know you had a little duo with my friend Sean.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do any? I know you do a lot of your own songs with that duo, but do you do any of the 13th Floor Elevators tunes?
Yeah, every set I do one or two.
Which ones do you do?
I like to do She Lives, mm-hmm. Baby Blue, I Had to Tell You, Kingdom of Heaven, Slip Inside This House, You're Gonna Miss Me.
Okay. Do you do any other cover tunes besides 13th Floor Elevators?
I do Sweet Dream Baby. By Roy Orbison.
Oh, really? Now we were talking.
Sky just woke up.
I do Fast Life Rider by Johnny Winter.
Okay.
And where can we hear you? But we're coming up on that time. I noticed your chauffeur came in a few minutes ago. Where can folks, again, run down website, where folks can watch you play live, especially right here at Big Daddy's?
Yeah, I'm right here next month on the 17th, I think it is. I'm not sure. Right
That's
around
right.
there. And,
That's exactly right.
The third Friday.
I'm at Local Johnny's.
That's in Cave Creek?
At Cave Creek on the...
Regularly.
You know, all of this will be at fredmitchum.com. That weekend I play here, I'm also playing Janie's in Cave Creek on a Thursday. And
any gigs in the Cottonwood Verde area coming up?
None. I haven't broken into there yet.
I'm helping you. I'm working
on
it.
All right.
Cool.
And okay. Sky.
Yes, sir.
Plug away.
Plug what?
Plug away. Website, gigs.
For my stuff?
Your stuff,
okay.
Here, wherever.
Okay. Well, when
it'll be up Monday.
Okay.
This will be at Monday. So you're playing somewhere tonight. You're probably playing somewhere tomorrow night.
Yeah, we'll
and those shows went great. They were packed
they
out.
Were
oh,
they were fabulous. They were fabulous.
Oh, man.
Absolutely fabulous.
So what you got coming up?
I wish I brought my calendar. I'm playing every day, and I just don't even remember
where
I'm playing.
You're every day in the Prescott area, down in the valley periodically.
I will be right here at Big Daddy E's on Friday.
This coming, so that'll be like, what, the 23rd, 24th, something
exactly.
like that?
Exactly, yeah.
Every Friday out here from 4:30 to 6:30, live music today, which was a great show because it already happened when this posted.
P.K. Gregory.
P.K. Gregory.
Yeah, P.K. Gregory.
Sky has been getting some great people out on that patio. So every Friday, 4:30 to 6:30. Les, what do you got coming up?
What do you want now? What is it, man?
What do you got coming up?
Well, so this will come out Monday, so Friday and Saturday I'll be at Cork and Cuisine.
Cork and Cuisine.
Yeah, be at Cork and Cuisine, and I'm probably going to meander around and cause trouble during the rest of the week.
If anybody wants to talk to Les, just walk around Prescott, up and down Montezuma and Gurley, that area. Look for the guy that looks like a serial killer, and that is... Leslie Earl.
No, that's your son. That's your son, the guy with the hammer.
Thank you so much for your time. Have you eaten here yet?
I'm about to.
We're about to, yeah. You got to check out Big Daddy E's since he's letting us take up space. Thanks again, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
Thanks.
Well, that's our show. Thanks for tuning in. That was Fred Mitchum from the patio at Big Daddy E's Barbecue. Check out Eric Veneer's menu and hours at BigDaddyEase.com. Check out Fred's info, schedule, and music, his contact. Pick up his CDs at FredMitchum.com, where you will find links to his social media, his iTunes, all that good stuff. And don't forget, every Friday at 4:30 to 6:30 in the afternoon. Friday afternoons at Big Daddy E's. Great music out there in the patio. We'll talk to you next week. Rising to the surface. For a moment, hold it in your hands on purpose. Your hands are equal to your eyes. Vision through touch, you can visualize a likeness of yourself in multiple universes. An infinite reaction in a limited space. A star factory in your fireplace. So, generator.